This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kank in for Jane Lindholm. In the last 18 months, Vermont's child welfare system has been under scrutiny, and there's wide agreement that all parts of the system are under strain. When state agencies investigate a case of alleged child abuse, neglect, or abandonment, a court-appointed volunteer is assigned to represent the child in that case. That volunteer is called a guardian ad litem, which means guardian for the lawsuit, GAL for short. Today on the program, we're going to talk about what GALs do, how they're trained, and how they work with other people in the child welfare system to protect our most valuable and vulnerable kids, rather. Listeners, do you have experience with this? Are you or have you been a guardian ad litem? We'd love to hear what you think about the job. Or maybe you were represented by a guardian ad litem when you were a child. 800-639-2211 is the number to call to join our conversation today. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on our webpage at vpr.net. Joining us from our Montpelier studio is David Kennedy, the Guardian Ad Litem Program Manager for the state of Vermont. David Kennedy, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Nina. Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned some of the instances when a guardian ad litem is called for, say, in cases of neglect, abuse, or abandonment. Walk us through how and when a child is assigned a guardian ad litem. Who does the assigning, and at what point in the process does that occur?
Okay. So for abuse and neglect cases, which I will probably intersperse and call CHINS cases as well, which is child in need of services. Once a child is taken into custody, there's an emergency hearing. If the case moves forward, the child is assigned a guardian ad litem. So the court appoints a guardian ad litem, but the actual assignment of a particular, like, human being guardian ad litem comes through the work of the juvenile docket clerk, who contacts the guardians of that county and fills some basic information about the case and asks for somebody to volunteer to take the case.
So if the family has multiple children, are different guardians ad litem assigned to each child, or is one assigned to a family representing each sibling? How does that work?
For the most part, one guardian ad litem would have every child involved in that case.
So if someone is assigned a case, say, with a single 9-year-old, what's the first thing the guardian ad litem does?
I think the way to think about what the guardian ad litem is trying to accomplish, and that is to get to know not just the child and establish a relationship of trust with that child, but also to know everything they can about that child's current circumstances. So one of the first things you want to do is talk to the child. 9-year-olds would be engaging, and you can talk to them. You can find out where they are. If they're there, they can spend time at that moment talking to them. If not, they start making appointments, try to get there and see them as soon as they can.
And are they talking to them in the child's home, in school, in a separate place apart from the family?
Yeah, all of the above. A lot of it depends on where they're placed. So during the process, if a child remains under the court's jurisdiction, so they can either be in DCF custody or at home or with a family member on what's called a conditional custody order. So the GAL will often go into that home to meet with the child. The GAL often goes into the school to meet with the child. Those are really the two main locations. If they're in a foster family, they'll go to that foster family. A child in custody might change foster homes several times during a case. The GAL will go to all those homes. So wherever really they can get to the child, but for the most part, school and home would be the top two.
And David, you were saying the guardian's main focus is to try to get to know the child and understand that individual child's situation. How does it work if they're assigned an infant or a really young child that can't communicate?
Well, I think so it's more than just getting to know the child. It's getting to the information they need to make an objective determination of that child's best interests. So when a child's old enough, they may express wishes of one sort or another, and that's not necessarily going to be what the guardian finds.
Hmm.
Because what they need to look at is the totality of what's happening. So for an infant, there are some developmental benchmarks you want to look at. And when they're talking to the child, they're playing a game or they're watching the child focus or interact. They can assess the nourishment and that sort of thing. I mean, obviously, the more you can engage the child and get feedback from the child, I think the easier that determination is. The other thing I should say is that this doesn't happen in a day. So it's not that they get assigned a child, they know everything in a day or in a week or even in a month and go from there. They're often working hand in hand and sharing information with social workers from DCF and getting other people. That's why they talk to the school, healthcare providers, service providers, anyone really who's engaged in taking care of that child to get a sense of how that child is doing. And the one thing, just real quick, to separate from that, no part of that is investigating whether or not the allegations of abuse or neglect actually happened.
So they're not investigators.
That is not, no, not at all. In fact, it's expressly, repeatedly articulated in training. That's not what they're there for. Their only job is to figure out what the child needs right now, what the best interests of the child will be, and to make sure that those interests are considered during the process.
And at what point are the guardians asked to speak up and present their finding? Is it just when the families are in court, or at what point does their information and input come into play?
Well, so I think a lot of this is I'll give you the overall sense. So one thing I should point out is that Vermont, each county is going to work slightly differently. A lot of sort of the daily interactions is going to be dependent on some personalities involved in there. But overall, I think it's fair to say that it works like there are team meetings that DCF puts on that the guardians usually are invited to and should be invited to, where they can participate and add things that maybe aren't noticed. The guardian works closely with the child's attorney. And so oftentimes the guardian will find they'll convey to the attorney, especially if they need some sort of advocacy, because the guardians can't, they're not able to make motions in court. They're not able to independently initiate a court process. So they often rely upon that partnership with the court, I mean with the attorney. The information sharing, that's where they get to get that information out. So the more information that they can gather, the more that they can convey, the more that they can ensure that it's considered in this process. So when there is a hearing, the child's attorney will have been informed either, you know, before the hearing or earlier in the week or month about what was going on and represents those findings to the court. In almost every hearing, and I'll tell the exception in a second, the judge may ask if a guardian if there's anything else. And oftentimes there's not, because that's conveyed thoroughly by the child's attorney.
Huh.
The one time where that is not true and a very different role for the guardian is in the merits portion of this process, which is where the court determines whether or not a child is actually in need of services, right? And the guardian ad litem does not participate in that. And if there is an opinion offered by the guardian, which is, again, rare, it has to be based on the evidence that's been submitted into the court. So, because, again, they're not investigators. They have no information about whether or not something actually occurred. And that's not what the focus of their work is.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about guardians ad litem, the role of these community volunteers in our child welfare system. My guest today is David Kennedy. He is the guardian ad litem program manager for the state of Vermont. We'd love to hear from you on this topic. You can call us at 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you've been a guardian ad litem or are one now and have some input to share. Or you can go to our Facebook page and post your thoughts there. Pam in Middlebury writes this email to us. I am one of the juvenile defenders in Addison County. Our office contracts with the state to represent primary juveniles in juvenile court cases. We work with guardian ad litems on an almost daily basis. GALs have a really hard job, but one that is very helpful to the juvenile's attorney. Most of them provide me with email summaries of their contacts with the parents and the visits with children and other collateral sources, school counselors, for example. They can provide valuable information about the parents and the juveniles that help inform our work in representing the child. And she says, my hat goes off to GALs. Susan Hong, a GAL, told Vermont Edition last year, I'm not there to hang out with kids. It's not a good reason to do this type of work. If you want to hang out with kids, you should be a mentor. I thought that was a good point. So, David, what kind of person, what are the skill sets that are needed for this kind of work? Because it does sound really difficult.
You know, I think it is. I think to one thing that I want to, I should always just say volunteer GAL when I say GAL, because these are volunteers. These are people from various professional backgrounds, various educational backgrounds. Some of them are retired. A lot of them are retired. Some of them are still working and fitting this in. And they are some of the most remarkable people I've had the fortune of meeting. And I think that the thing that, you know, I don't know that there's one quality that they need to have. I think some of the qualities that they should have or at least value are patience. These are very complex situations and in an overtaxed system, and it is hard to coordinate everything that needs to get coordinated. Flexibility, objectivity, and some resiliency. These cases, when you hear the details of them, they're tragic. I mean, they break your heart.
Mm.
But when they make determinations, they need to make determinations about the best interests of the child in the sense, not what would they do for their own kid, but for this child, what is in this child's best interest and what is needed to put him in a safe and permanent home. And those are very different questions than maybe you and I, if we were reading the newspaper description of a story, might decide. And so, you know, I think the cases could take a long time, so they have to have a commitment to the work. You can't come in for a weekend and be a guardian ad litem.
Well, explain how much training is involved. You get somebody who's interested and calls up and says, I'm interested. What's explained to them first about the training involved?
So there's a pretty thorough screening component before we even get to training. We have a pretty lengthy application, and then there's an interview process, and then we do a federal and state search, including abuser registry and sexual offender registry, searches of everybody. So assuming everyone gets through that, we talk a lot about sort of what the commitment will be. You know, 2 years, can you do it for 2 years? Are you going to be able to make court appearances during the day? Not every day, but, you know, sometimes can you do this? You have a flexible enough schedule to allow you to do that. And then we have 32 hours of what we call pre-service training. What I should say is that Vermont guardian ad litems and other states are sometimes known as court-appointed special advocates, and there's a national organization that sets standards and creates curriculum for training called National CASA. And we use the National CASA training to do 32 hours of subject matter training for GAL candidates, which is 24 hours of classes, 8 hours of independent work. And then they do a mentoring with a seasoned GAL where they follow that GAL around, see what happens in the case, ask a lot of questions, get to really understand what's expected for each case. And when that person feels that they're ready, they can be assigned a case. And then that case is supported by the mentor. And also, in most of the counties, we have paid coordinators who are part-time supervisors who are able to provide guidance and assistance as well as work on issues like recruitment and training and organization and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of support that goes into the beginning part of GAL's career to get them to the point where they are independent enough to take on whatever cases they feel capable of taking on.
I want to remind listeners of our phone number if they want to call in and join the program today, 1-800-639-2211. We're talking about the job of guardians ad litem, the volunteers who represent children who are in crisis oftentimes. It sounds like a difficult job. Maybe you've done it and can share your thoughts with us. Again, 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments or questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So you were talking about the training that's involved as well as the background checks, mm-hmm. Just to get into the program. Once someone becomes a guardian ad litem, how much of a time commitment might they see on a weekly or monthly basis?
You know, I've been trying to get a real handle on what I can say is like a reliable number. In the beginning of every case, there's a lot more time in the beginning part of a case. And then once you get enough information, then a lot of it is just continuing to check in with the child. So, you know, one visit a month is what we ask them to do. So depending on how long the case goes and where you are in the case, it differs. But I think what I'm comfortable saying is that for each child, it's about 5 to 10 hours a month. And so if you have one family with four children, that could be 20 to 40 hours in that month. And then there's obviously months that are going to be less and some that are going to be more. But I think that that's what I would say. And the problem is, one of the problems is that a case, like we just said, could have more than one child. So you might have time for a case, and the ones that come forward might have two or three children. And then what we encourage the volunteers to do is say no unless they know that they're able to do what they need to do for that particular case. And sometimes we have the luxury of being able to say no. So
1-800-639-2211, our phone number. If you'd like to join today's program, we're talking about guardians ad litem. We've got a call now from Marcia, who's calling from Pulteney. Hi, Marcia. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. I was a guardian ad litem for 3 years for the Rutland County. I went into it after I retired from nursing. I was very, I felt like I was well qualified for the job and an eager learner. I ultimately had to leave because I found more and more was being asked of us as volunteers, and it became totally all-consuming.
How much time were you putting in, Marcia?
Oh, I was putting in, yeah, I had 7 kids. I had them actually around the state because even if they're from Rutland County, they might be placed with a grandparent, as was one of my kids who was up on the border of Vermont in Canada. I had one in Bennington in a school, and I had one down near Windsor in placement.
Wow.
And we were encouraged to visit our kids once a month, plus go to the school meetings, plus go to the court hearings. And when you go to the court hearing, it's only on Thursday. That's the only day for family court. And it is a madhouse. There are so many cases scheduled that you just can't even believe it. You're running late almost immediately. It starts at 8 and it goes till 4. And your case might be scheduled for 10, but you could easily not get in till after lunch.
Marcia,
you're allowed 15 minutes per kid in the courtroom, and it gets backlogged almost within an hour.
I can hear the frustration. I just wanted one follow-up, Marcia. Did you feel that you had adequate backup when you had questions? Did you feel that your regional supervisor or whoever your point person was could answer questions when they came up?
I mean, sure, but it wasn't the answering of questions. It was trying to handle the load. And there are at that time, there were 125 new kids in Rutland County who needed guardian ad litems.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mandated that every minor who's in DCF custody have a guardian ad litem assigned to them. And we didn't have more than a couple dozen GAL, so you do the math, and so
it was a lot.
It didn't matter that I wasn't getting the questions answers. It was trying to do a decent job for these kids and trying to help with a very impacted system.
Well, Marcia, let me let David Kennedy pick that up. You've brought up, I think, some pretty serious issues. You know, the issues that Marcia's brought up, just traveling. I had no idea that, you know, the travel requirements, she was traveling all over the state.
Yeah.
Are the comments that she's just made, are those ones that you've heard a lot? Is it unusual or is that par for the course?
I should mention that I've been doing this since the middle of May. So I've been the fortunate part of that is I've been able to sort of look at it from a detached view and get a sense of what's going on. So first of all, Marcia, thank you so much for the time you did spend. I hear your frustration. I think that one of the things that is that Marcia illustrates is just the scope of the need for Vermont's most vulnerable children, for abused and neglected children in Vermont. Right now we have about 270 volunteers, and they're handling about 2,100 children.
Wow.
And that's only in abuse and neglect cases. So that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot. It averages out to about 8 kids per GAL. And the National ACOSTA standard is about 4. While that's not different in terms of, like, increased caseload than the other parties, like the DCF has very similar issues, these are volunteers. And I think that, you know, I say that I encourage people to say no when they're feeling overworked, and hopefully that message is getting out more. But it's hard to say no, because when you're committed to the job, I'm sure if Marcia's still here, you know what kind of difference you're making. And if you feel that if you don't do it, somebody else won't, I think there's a lot of people who feel it's harder for some people to say no than others. And so, I think she raises some really valid points. And there's, unfortunately, there's certain times when things boil down to numbers. And since we are statutorily required to put a GAL there,
There's some stressors.
Yeah. And you know, and so one of the things that I'm really focusing on is trying to find opportunities to recruit more GALs, obviously, from various backgrounds, and then try to get the trainings to be more frequent so people can get up and running faster.
Well, let me jump in here. I'd like to take a quick break. For those of you just tuning in, we're talking about guardians ad litem today on the program, the role they play in protecting kids in the state. My guest is David Kennedy, the guardian ad litem program manager for the state of Vermont. We'll get into more about training and recruitment after this break. We'll also get to more of your calls. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Today we're talking about guardians ad litem. David Kennedy is my guest. He's the guardian ad litem program manager for the state of Vermont. We'd love to hear from you on this topic at 1-800-639-2211. 1-800-639-2211. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Take a call from Brattleboro. Emily is on the line. Hi, Emily. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I want to offer a different perspective, and it's a personal one to me, which was having a guardian ad litem assigned to my family during a hotly contested divorce. Mm-hmm. And some of the concerns that I had was that the 32-hour training seems very minimal, and I got involved into a group called the Battered Mothers Custody Conference, and there's a lot of talk about volunteer guardian ad litems versus other states where the guardian ad litems are in fact attorneys and they charge a fee or are paid minimally to who understand the law, who have a deeper understanding about the needs of children and what the dynamics look like. So my concern is that oftentimes in small towns, guardian ad litems know people through people. I don't think that they necessarily hold true to some kind of ethics that a lawyer would need to in terms of confidentiality and inserting their own biases. And that was certainly not just my experience, but the experience of many. So I guess I'm wondering why the state of Vermont is, and you've spoken about some burnout from volunteers or volunteers feeling, if I don't do it, nobody will, which kind of goes along with the idea that sometimes people who are feeling that way aren't going to be as effective. So why isn't the state of Vermont taking on this role more seriously and having people with deeper training like lawyers
Emily,
be the ones responsible for these children who were referred to as our most needy?
David Kennedy, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So a couple things. One, Emily's talking about domestic cases. And I think that the training and National CASA in general really focuses on abuse and neglect cases. So there's a different set of skills that go into domestic. And I think that you know, when I talked about the numbers, those didn't include other types of cases they get assigned to, like some probate cases, domestic cases, mental health cases, and some delinquency cases. We have specialized training for delinquency, and we're working on trainings for others. But this is really, if you can just hearing what I'm describing, get a sense of how big the responsibility is to expect the guardian ad litem to serve as a child's attorney and have sort of that similar skill set and education, I think, is missing what the GAL is supposed to be. Emily referenced what some other states do. And other states, when they say guardian ad litem or court-appointed special advocate, only mean for abuse and neglect cases. So for domestic cases, they're basically appointing a state-appointed attorney for the child. And, I mean, so I'm also really reluctant to sort of draw conclusions based on one case or one experience. Not that I doubt anything Emily's saying, but I think that when you look at the work as a whole, to think that what you didn't have would be better when you have no experience in that other thing, I don't know that I agree with that as a premise.
Well, one of Emily's points, I think, and it's been brought up before, is that many states offer a stipend and that people that does attract lawyers or even retired attorneys to do that work. I think New Hampshire has a guardian ad litem fund that people have to pay into that pays out to the guardians to provide them with some compensation. Mm-hmm. Why does Vermont choose to keep it strictly voluntary with no stipend involved?
Well, so I don't want to talk to address the question of like what Vermont is or is like it, whether they discussed this and rejected it or whether it hasn't come up. Like, I just don't know. So I don't want to address that part. I also think there is a misconception that – so there's guardian ad litem, there's court-appointed special advocates, and this is really nuanced, and I apologize. But with National CASA, the model is a volunteer model. then most states for abuse and neglect cases do not pay their guardians ad litem.
Hmm.
The states where the guardians ad litem get paid are a different role. And it's confusing because each state uses different terms. But basically what they are attorneys who act both as sort of the child's attorney and do some responsibility for the guardian ad litem role. And it's, depending on who you talk to, it's either the best of both worlds or the worst of both. And, you know, so to address, when we're talking about guardians ad litem who are assigned for children, I think that you are talking about a volunteer model in general, with some cases where if the judge is going to order a domestic case, which, like Emily described, is contentious, and they're going to assign a guardian ad litem, they charge the family for that service like they would for any additional resource that's used. So again, it's not as simple as there are guardians who get paid and are guardians who don't. Our guardians get mileage reimbursement, which is not a lot, but most states don't do reimbursement.
Well, let me take a couple more phone calls before we run out of time. Let's go to Burlington and talk to Joe. Hi, Joe. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
My comment today was going to be I was a child in a neighboring state that got assigned a guardian ad litem. I have other family members, so there were other children in the house that also got assigned. And you could tell that it was a volunteer, but also it was one of the first times throughout my parents' divorce, which was very much about their disagreements, that I felt like I was being listened to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to comment that even though it seems like there maybe isn't a lot of training, at least in my personal experience, a court was able to make a decision that really helped me become a more successful adult because I had some amount of control, or maybe not control, but I felt like someone was trying to address my needs for me that weren't my disagreeable parents, who were also looking out for their own interests and kind of getting everything sorted out. And so even though they are volunteers, my personal experience has been that the people that come in and are involved in their training, they already have some kind of background that does lend itself to being objective and really helping meet the child's needs. And my needs ended up being different than the other children in the household. And that was addressed, and actually the court system was able to find a way that everything could work out for the best of the children involved in the case.
Joe, thanks very much for the call. I'd like to go to one more call now from St. Albans. Bridget, you're on Vermont Edition.
Hi, Nina. Hi, David. Thank you so much for having this show. I'm a foster parent. I'm fostering three young children who, when they came into the care of our home, were under the age of three. So these are nonverbal kiddos. And we had no contact with our guardian ad litem and found out that the previous foster home where the kids had been for a year had no contact with the guardian ad litem other than phone calls. So by the time we got into 8 months of having these kids in our home, we still had not had a visit from the guardian ad litem. And I won't go into too much detail, but I'm finding from our experience, I mean, I had to do a lot of chasing down in order to have the guardian ad litem and another guardian ad litem added to our case because we knew that we, as the foster parents, couldn't advocate for the needs of the kids legally in court. So I guess what I began to think about was, how do we work some accountability into this? Are there follow-up trainings? Are there ways that supervisors are able to check in with guardian ad litems? And like Emily mentioned, would a paid system or, you know, a stipend or something be able then to maybe hold people a little bit more accountable for the work that they're supposed to be doing?
Thanks for the call, Bridget. David, why don't you pick that up?
Sure. So two things. One, Bridget, I'm david.kennedy@vermont.gov. So if you get something like that, be in touch. We don't want that to continue. And so I don't know the particulars of your case. So I'm sorry that was your experience. But I think with training and a stipend, I think there's two parts that go into training. One is our accountability. One is the ability to train the way we'd like to. And two is the ability to supervise the way we want to. Talking to guardians ad litem, they want accountability. They want more training. We have me in the central office. We have four coordinators who are part-time and total 1.7 full-time employees for the 270 employees that we, for guardians ad litem that we have. A system of accountability, if we're going to do it, maybe a stipend would be a something that would be a carrot, but we also need the personnel to be able to do the sort of assessment and follow-up that you're talking about. And so I think that when we're talking about holding people accountable, I think what we need to think about is the circumstances around their actual situation, hold them accountable for performance within those circumstances. And, you know, if we had the ability and resources we needed to have the infrastructure to do that sort of accountability, we would do it. And the GALs would welcome it.
I'm going to take one last phone call from Gene. Gene, we've got about 30 seconds left, but I wanted to give you the last word. Go ahead. You're on Vermont Edition.
Okay, great. So I am a current guardian. And one thing that I'd like people to know is that as a retiree, I have anything I can do with my time, right? I don't have any specific requirements. I don't have to go to a specific job at a specific time. But I choose to do this. I choose to do the guardian work. It is difficult. It is time-consuming. And many of the people that I know who also make that choice do so with a level of commitment that's at least as high as they had when they were employed, and maybe even higher because they're doing it all for free. So we do care about kids. We do our best, and we do try to maintain continuous education in the process.
Gene, thank you so much for that call.
Hi,
and
Gene,
David Kennedy, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Nana. Thanks for having me.
David Kennedy is the Guardian Ad Litem Program Manager for the state of Vermont. He joined us from our studios in Montpelier. Coming up, some call them Vermont's most dangerous leftovers. This coming Saturday, more than 50 law enforcement offices, rescue departments, and pharmacies in Vermont will team up for the state's annual Drug Takeback Day. It's an effort to make sure unused prescription drugs don't fall into the wrong hands. That's next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kankin for Jane Lindholm. The problem of opiate addiction is well known in Vermont and across the country. For many, the addiction begins with prescription pills. This weekend, law enforcement agencies across the country are organizing an event to get unused prescription drugs out of medicine cabinets so they can be disposed of properly. The goal is to get these unused narcotics out of circulation so they don't get into the hands of addicts. Eric Miller is the U.S. Attorney for Vermont, and he joins me now. His office prosecutes federal drug crimes in the state, and it's a key supporter of this weekend's Drug Takeback Day. Eric Miller, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Nina. Thank you for having me.
So explain how the state is running Drug Take Back Day in Vermont. How does it work?
Sure. This is how it works. As you know, so many of us, if we open our medicine cabinets or open our drawers, have old prescription medications that we just don't want or need anymore. And it would be easy to conclude that they're harmless just sitting there. But we know that's not the case. As our health commissioner, Harry Chen, said, these are among Vermont's most dangerous leftovers. So this coming Saturday, September 26th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., state, federal, and local agencies are getting together to set up over 60 spots within the state where people can bring the prescription medications that they have but don't want or need anymore. They can go to those locations, drop them off, no questions asked, and together, state, federal, and local agencies will make sure that they get disposed of properly.
So where can people find out where the nearest drop-off point is for them?
There's two ways to find the nearest drop-off point. One is to go to www.dea.gov, or the other is to call 800-882-9539. And through either of those mechanisms, you can find a location or, in many instances, a number of locations very near you.
And listeners will have links to that information on our website. So if you didn't catch it, go to vpr.net anytime to get that info. So, Eric Miller, explain why these drugs are such dangerous leftovers.
I think there's really three reasons why they are dangerous. Number one, drugs that are sitting around a home can be subject to accidental misuse by patients or their family members. And that's a real problem in Vermont and across the country. Second, of course, drugs that are sitting unused can be the subject of purposeful misuse or diversion to others who will misuse or abuse them. And then finally, if people know that others have unused medications, particularly opiate pain medications sitting around the house, that house can be a magnet for property or violent crime. Obviously, those three things are all events that we'd like to avoid and minimize in Vermont.
Well, I remember about 10 years ago interviewing some recovering addicts in Rutland for a series I was doing at the time on prescription drug use. A drug abuse, rather, and many admitted that they did. They started getting their drugs at the homes of friends and relatives. They'd sort of sneak into the parents' bathroom and or the grandparents' bathroom and take whatever they wanted. And that just seemed to be the norm.
I will, you know, the governor recently wrote that prescription opiate abuse ignited the current heroin crisis in Vermont and elsewhere. And your experience talking to addicts and the governor's statement is very true for so many. People start by using, very often, people start by using prescription pain medications, either medications prescribed to them or medications prescribed to friends or family members. And when those prescription medications run out, they turn to a cheaper alternative. And for the most part, heroin is a cheaper alternative to abusing prescription pain medications.
Saturday's Drug Take Back Day, those sorts of events have been going on for a while. Is there any data to show that they're having an impact on this sort of thing?
There is. Last year's event, September 2014, produced 309 tons, that's tons, of collected medication across the country. In Vermont alone, last September's Drug Take Back Day collected 3,300 pounds from Vermonters. So that is a significant quantity of unused, unwanted, but potentially dangerous medications being taken out of people's homes so that they can be disposed of properly.
And when you talk about disposing of properly, why is it a bad idea to just flush something down the toilet or down the sink?
You know, we don't want medications sitting in cabinets, but we also don't want them either heading to the landfill where they're going to sit or be possibly discovered or misused, nor do we want them put into the water system where there is at least the potential that they could have an adverse environmental impact. And here in Vermont, as you know, fighting the opiate problem is one of our top priorities, but protecting our environment is also among the things that are most important to us.
So what will happen with all of the pills and the medicines that you do collect?
So it is important to remember that the medicines that can be collected need to be in solid form. They're pills, they're capsules, but not liquid.
Not liquid, okay.
But when those solid medications are collected, they get consolidated within Vermont and then consolidated regionally and nationally, and they're sent to a company that is in the business of disposing of them safely and in a way that doesn't harm people and obviously minimizes potential harm to the environment as well.
Eric Miller is the U.S. Attorney for Vermont. We've been talking about the National Drug Take Back Day that will be held this Saturday. More than 50 locations in Vermont will be open to receive unwanted prescription drugs. You can find a location near you by following a link we have posted at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Eric Miller, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
This Friday evening, a coalition of groups interested in bicycle safety will rally at the State House. Local Motion, the Vermont Highway Safety Alliance, are launching an initiative called the Vermont Road Users Pledge. The pledge states, quote, "I promise to follow the rules of the road, respect the rights of all road users, and share what I know about road safety with others." In the spirit of that pledge, drivers and cyclists have a responsibility to keep the roads safe for everyone. But learning to cycle safely in traffic can be challenging. Our producer, Patty Daniels, enlisted the advice of a local motion riding instructor to learn how to commute to work safely.
I live in Winooski, and the road I drive to work in Colchester is Route 15, 2.5 miles of busy four-lane traffic, not ideal for bikes.
It's not something I would ever choose to ride on. It's just too scary.
That's Jason Van Dreisch, Director of Advocacy and Education for Local Motion.
And it's the combination of nowhere to go, that there's no shoulder at all and no bike lane, and really fast, really heavy traffic. And honestly, it's just way too much exposure for me, because I know if anything goes wrong, who's going to come out with the short end of the stick.
Van Dreisch's role on this breezy day is to teach me how to get to work on my bike. I learned to ride a bike as a kid, but I'm not much of a cyclist now. So for the purposes of this story, consider me able and willing, but not highly skilled. We start out from the center of Winooski, where traffic enters and exits a rotary from several directions, cars streaming by, impatient in the morning commute. First lesson, you are not a car. Don't think like a car. Don't plan your route for a car.
What we're doing right now, there's analogs for this all over Vermont, where the obvious logical car route doesn't look so appealing on a bike. So you say, all right, what are the other options? So a lot of figuring out where you want to ride on a bike is contextual. It's not just about the street. It's about the time of day. It's about your own energy level and how you're feeling that day. You change your mindset. We're turning left here. Now go ahead.
Route 15 is the most direct route from my neighborhood to VPR. But we're taking roads less traveled. Van Dreisch has us zigzag through quiet residential streets that I would never go through if I were driving in a car. But to get to those safe, quiet streets, we still have to cross Route 15, and it's kind of ugly.
Ostensibly, this is a spot where they're expecting people to cross, but looking at everything going on here, that we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 different streets coming in, plus railroad tracks, nobody stops, and you don't know if somebody's going to go this way or that way. When you're on a bike, one real important principle is avoid unpredictable situations.
And that's lesson two. Do what you can to avoid intersections like this, but minimize the danger if you do have to cross them.
Railroad tracks. Your best bet with railroad tracks is to hit it at a 90-degree angle, because if you hit it at a steep angle, you might get your tires caught, and that's no fun.
Which leads to lesson three. When in traffic, be consistent in how you ride.
I operate on the assumption that being visible and predictable is always going to be my best bet. Because if I'm biking in a way where I'm giving them obvious cues about what I'm doing and I'm not changing what I'm doing from one second to the next, then there's less for them to be guessing about.
If bike commuting sounds like a utilitarian way of getting from point A to point B, the next turn in our route was a nice surprise. Woods! We cruise along a dirt trail in a forested park, which is lesson four. Are you allowed to enjoy commuting to work? Yes. Yes, you are.
So all of a sudden, we've left the interstate behind, and we're on a beautiful little single track going by Winooski's old municipal reservoir. Yeah, with giant trees and all kinds of green growing stuff everywhere, and all of a sudden it's peaceful and quiet.
We exit the woods, and we can see in the distance that traffic is heavy on Route 15. But again, we take a quiet side street that leads to VPR. So here's the recap of our commute. A drive that is normally 15 minutes of stop-and-go traffic took 10 minutes longer on a bike, but it was quieter and more fun and not nearly as challenging as I expected. And then Van Dreisch leaves me with this final lesson on safety.
I wear a helmet, but it's not the only thing I do. I'm always really aware of my surroundings, tracking what's going on around me, making sure I know where cars are, what everybody's doing. I ride in a straight line. I don't weave in and out of parked cars. I signal when I'm going to make turns.
But he says, ultimately, it's drivers who make the biggest difference to a cyclist's safety.
I'm confident that the vast majority of drivers in Vermont are horrified at the thought of potentially hurting somebody who's riding a bike.
For VPR News, I'm Patty Daniels.
And you can learn more about Local Motion's Everyday Bike Program classes and the state's new Vermont Road Users Pledge. Visit vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. And that is Vermont Edition for today. Tomorrow, we're hosting a political roundtable. We've invited some of the state's best political reporters to look at who's in and who's out so far in the early scramble of candidates for governor and lieutenant governor. And we'll look at some surprising poll numbers on those races. That's all tomorrow on Vermont Edition. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.